Okay, we're moving into the section of our study now where we focus for a couple of sessions on the, specifically on the textbook that you have. I hope you've already been reading it. We're going to do a quick flyover of the first part of this book. If you look with me at the table of contents, if you brought that with you this morning, after you look at the, it says, the value of the laws of interpretation, we'll talk about that very briefly. And then the axioms of hermeneutics. Even though he only lists just a single line for that chapter in his book, those are so very important for us, and hopefully you'll come to realize that. And then after he looks at the axioms, then he starts looking at what he calls rules, the preliminary rules of interpretation, and then rules based on the general sense, rules based on the meaning of words and expressions. Then he moves into the use of parallel passages and figurative language. We probably won't, in class, in detail, cover all of that directly. I do expect you to read all of that. That would be down to the end of page 189. In fact, your assignment is by the end of this term to have read the entire book. But I particularly am holding you accountable for having read down through 189. And to whatever extent we don't cover some of those first 189 pages, I expect you to read your book and take notes on it into your notes. The pencil is the best eyes in some cases. If you write it down, you're much more likely to remember it. I've discovered after, 37 years or something like that of preaching, if I write it down in my notes, I'll remember to say it when I'm speaking, even if I don't see it again in my notes. I seldom look at my notes while I preach. The notes were being made in my head while I was writing them on the paper. And I know part of that is 37 years of doing it, but so take notes on what you're reading here. Now, I stopped at 189 because the last section, even though I want you to read it, I'm not holding you as accountable for that because a much more updated view of those same subjects appear in our second textbook, How to Read the Bible for All It's Worth. And that section of this book deals with the same thing as that textbook does, the subject of realizing there are different genres or different kinds of literature. And while they're all subject to the same general principles of interpretation, each one of them have some characteristics that are unique to them and have some additional rules or principles that apply. And we recognize that ourselves. If I had brought a hymn book up here with me that we sing from, and we just looked at the words in some of those hymns, that's a special genre of literature. And we don't try to interpret the hymns we sing by all the same concepts and principles as we do the daily newspaper when we read it. What's one of the most outstanding characteristics about hymns?
Figurative language.
Figurative language, that's right. Brilliant, oftentimes feeling-laden figures of speech even. And so we look at these different genres of literature, poetry, prophecy, law, history, epistles, with slightly different points of view, realizing that they have some things that are unique to them. And so, like I say, you're primarily responsible for having taken notes on the first 189 pages here. But now join me. I'm going to do a little something that I've seen Ed Wharton do. If you take a couple of his classes, he'll pull out his own book sometime and read to you from it. That's an interesting concept. Of course, this isn't my book, but I still find it interesting. If you turn with me to the very first page of of the first chapter, which would be number 13, but there's not a number on that page, called Principles of Interpretation, Chapter 1. This book is written by Clinton Lockhart. In his day, a very scholarly man, well recognized in scholarly circles, not just in church circles, but in scholarly circles. PhD from Yale University in 1894. Not sure what all else he did, but I checked, double checked again this morning on Texas Christian University's website, and sure enough, he's still listed as the president of that university from, I think, 1911 to 1915, and held other prestigious positions like that. He was considered a Greek scholar, as well as a New Testament scholar, and accomplished in several other fields, obviously of school administration and so forth as well. But he says here at the beginning of this, he says, it is not hoped that any number of axioms and rules of interpretation will compensate the unfortunate interpreter who is lacking in good judgment and sound common sense. This is so true in all areas of life. You just can't make enough rules or guidelines or principles or even pass laws in our legislature sufficient to protect people from their own lack of common sense. And that's also true when it comes to this area. We still need to exercise good judgment, sound thinking. These rules are not here to replace that. They're here to supplement and support your ability to think clearly, logically, critically. Laws of all sciences presuppose the ability in him who would use them. Rules of interpretation can no more make a good interpreter than the rules of poetry can make a good poet. Basically what he's saying, and even I think maybe says it in another place here, that you can give someone a box full of tools and explain to him what each one of them does, but that does not make him a mechanic. On the other hand, how could you be a mechanic without the tools? All you could do is just stare at the problem and perhaps try to guess at what it is, but you couldn't do nothing, you could do nothing to repair it. And so they go hand in hand. The axioms, principles, and rules of interpretation, and one who has acquainted themselves with the ability to use them. And now he launches in this first chapter on several observations about the value of the laws of interpretation. So I'm just going to hop, skip, and jump through here, and you can do your own reading of it. First of all, he says on page 14, we do not have a perfect system of hermeneutics. That was not only true in 1901 when he first wrote this, and in 1916 whenever he, or 15 when he updated it, but that's still true today. It's just like the laws in any other field of human research and endeavor. They're always discovering, or at least fine-tuning, the discoverable laws that have already been made. They're finding little ways that it needs to be tweaked a little bit to be even clearer. So he's not claiming that this is the be-all and end-all. That does not mean, number two, that they're useless. It only is acknowledging the truth as it is in every field of endeavor that while you still have, while you have these principles and you use them to, as a lens or a viewpoint to see things, they're incomplete, and that's of necessity that they are. Then he says at the top of page 15, it is not enough for practical use that a principle of interpretation should be only stated in its most general form. I'm sorry for the stilted language. Part of that is his scholarship. Part of it is the fact that he was writing 100 years ago, and people, even in our own language, language has changed in 100 years in the way people speak and write and talk. But what he's saying is that we can't be satisfied with just the most general principles. We have to go beyond that down to things that are more specific for them to be more useful to us. That's why when we talk over in the field of physics, we talk about gravity. It's not enough to say gravity is that attraction between two objects such that the larger object will tend to draw the smaller object toward itself. We've gone ahead and developed all the things that actually measure how fast the object can move towards the other object. Particularly, you know, if you go up on a tall building and drop the proverbial apple off the top of the building, they can calculate, and we did this when I was in physics in college, actually calculate how fast not only that object's falling, but it accelerates as it falls. It gets faster and faster until finally the resistance of the air is enough to stop it going any faster. But if it were being done in a vacuum, theoretically, it would fall at the rate of 32 feet per second until it hits the ground. 32 feet per second means it's traveling at 32 feet per second the first second, but 64 feet per second the second second, and 96 feet per second the third. Those are just the specifics that all began with a general principle about gravity. The same is true in this field of hermeneutics. And then he says, further down on that same page, 15, it's not enough for the student simply to study the principles and rules of hermeneutics. He must practically apply them. And he says at the bottom then, the last paragraph of that page, the laws of hermeneutics serve to rectify many mistakes of interpretation. And how true that is. I was so delighted that early in my career as a minister, I was exposed to this material because I think it gave me a clearer picture both in my own Bible study and in dealing with other folks both in the church and in other religious groups and even outside of all religious groups together, gave me a clearer picture of both where they're coming from and maybe what they're missing. And certainly it helped me to have a much clearer picture that it helps clarify and rectify a lot of mistakes that people make. Then he says at the top of page 16, very few people study the structure or try to learn the names of hundreds of common plants in the fields and by the roadside. Is it because they have no interest in them? Do they care nothing for nature's most abundant and most beautiful products? By no means. It is simply because they have not studied botany. So he's just suggesting that he's not casting everybody into a box or a bucket and saying they're just, you know, ignorant, uninterested students of God's Word if they don't know these things. He's just saying they haven't yet either been exposed to them or applied themselves to learn them. We're in the boat where we're trying to learn them. He says at the bottom of that page, only correct processes can be expected to bring correct results. Now, if it sounds like he's talking about hermeneutics as if it's some kind of science and there's laws and, you know, all this involved, it is. This view of interpretation goes somewhat contrary to the postmodern thinking of many today. And yet, I think the real experts in the areas of languages and interpretation and so forth, whether it's the Bible or something else, still recognize it is a science. And that's the way we view that, and I think we need to. It's not wishy-washy. It's just what we want to make it. It's what we want it to be. That is not true. You certainly can approach it that way, but the chances of you discovering real truth are pretty slim if you approach it that way. It's the same as it would be in any other field of research and endeavor. All right, then he moves us to what he calls the axioms of hermeneutics. I went to the American Heritage Dictionary, the online edition, of course, and pulled out their definition of what an axiom is. That might not be a word you use every day. I was first exposed to it When I was in high school and took geometry, that's the first time I ever, I think, heard anyone use that word. But we began our study of geometry, and in fact, the entire two-semester-long course, we constantly were called back to the axioms of geometry. An axiom is a universally recognized truth. In fact, it even says there twice, a self-evident. It's something that is a truth that's so widely recognized, it doesn't even require proof. It's just a fundamental assumption that everyone takes for granted. And sometimes you only take it for granted after you've been exposed to it. But nevertheless, that's what an axiom is. Now, why are they not subject to proof? Because they lie at the foundation of everything within that realm of study. I thought of a few examples in other areas that this is true of. For example, in the area of mathematics, I mentioned geometry, but all areas of mathematics are that way. Yes?
Did you go back
one? Yes, sir. That's okay. All areas of mathematics, and in fact, all areas of science have certain axioms, whether spoken or unspoken. And the truth is that in most areas of endeavor and human research, the axioms are even unspoken. Think with me for a moment about when you first started school, if you can remember back that far. Certainly by the time you started school, you'd already been exposed to mathematics on a certain level. For example, your parents or someone had helped you learn how to count. The ability to assign numbers to quantities is an axiom of mathematics. It's so fundamental, no one has to prove that. You've got one, you've got two, you've got three, whether it's fingers or apples or automobiles, you know. And that's just an axiom of basic mathematics. So you grasp from that what we mean by an axiom. It's sort of self-evident, but it was only self-evident after someone taught you that. Yes?
It reminds me a lot of, for instance, when my daughter eats her cereal.
Uh-huh.
She takes a bite and removes one portion from it. She takes another bite. Pretty soon she has none. She recognizes. She runs out of cereal.
Uh-huh.
She says, I need more cereal. But before someone explains to her what's going on, the math side of it, she's not thinking on that level.
That's right.
But it's one of those things that makes itself up.
Yes. It, as we were saying, in so many areas, it's assumed. It's such a fundamental principle, an axiom about that thing that no one ever even verbalizes it or scarcely ever does. And so when you go to school and they said, okay, we're going to start teaching you math, they start beyond the axioms, usually because you've already gotten those with whole numbers and counting and that you can quantify things based on numbers. And even in some cases, you've already learned on some kind of a fundamental level about adding and subtracting, at least. And in a sense, even multiplying and dividing, all they have to do is move on from the axioms over to the rules. When they start teaching you the multiplication table, they're not teaching you the axiom. They're actually teaching the rule. Rules are just the specific ways you apply the axiom. Yes, Kevin.
I disagree with number 9, though.
Okay.
Number 9 says that when someone's writing, the writer is trying one written thing, something written down is to convey one thought, and only one thought, and can only convey one thought.
Okay.
That's not.
Well, when we get to that, we will talk about that some. And again, this is the general axiom. If we move over into the text where he gets to some of the rules, we will find that sometime an author's purpose is to have an obvious meaning and even a hidden meaning. That's rare, but that does happen. But that was his purpose from the very beginning. And so he had only one purpose in mind from the beginning. That's how he intends for us to interpret that axiom. But
that's what I was saying. Uh-huh. If that's the way they're looking at it, saying this, our thought, my thought was this and this, mm-hmm. then yeah, I could see that.
But even so, that way of doing things is pretty rare in human language. Most of the time, people aren't trying to have a hidden meaning in a. Although some of us who are married have decided after so many years that so much of our communication with our spouse is on a couple of different levels. Sometimes what is said and then another level at what is meant. But yes.
It's very popular in music.
Mm-hmm.
For musicians to put hidden meanings in their lyrics.
Right. Mm-hmm. But that was their intended purpose at the beginning, and then it's our job as if we're, lovers of music, is to try to discover that. That's a principle. That's interpreting. He didn't put it there so we wouldn't discover it. He put it there, or she, so we would. But you might have to work at it a while. And I've even heard, even those that don't have lyrics, but even in music, I hear sometimes, boy, I don't know anything about music to speak of, but they'll talk about some of the great symphonies or other pieces that's composed by great musicians, and they'll talk about what's the major theme or the major something or another running through it, and then they'll talk about it, there'll be a minor refrain that's running through it too, where the musician has actually found a way to weave two different kinds of audible sounds together, and people can pick out the minor along with the major. And yes?
One thing, Steve. As far as like number 9 or 9 also, I mean, these are, there's multiple actions here, and you can't take any one. Neither one of them will work properly by themselves.
Yeah.
They all function within each other. Like, for instance, axiom 2 is objective interpretation. So, of course, interpretation is not the exact same thing as axiom 9, you know, one meaning,
mm-hmm.
because it involves interpretation. These things are meant to work hand in hand mm-hmm. with each other to produce the.
Yeah, taken all together, they provide a framework for talking about interpretation. And I think at a basic level, that's what we need to realize. So in mathematics, I just gave a few examples. The Declaration of Independence. Let's see, I think I have a copy. Did have a copy of that here somewhere. Just to read a small portion of it to you. Listen to this, probably the most famous section that all of us have heard the most from the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident. What are they saying right then?
We have this
axiom. Yes, these are some axioms in their opinion. That all men are created equal. They didn't feel like they had to argue that they had to prove that, or even defend that. They felt like they could state that as a self-evident truth. Not only did they hold that as an axiom, but that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. In other words, not only are all men created equal, but all men have certain rights they cannot justly have taken away from them. Such as, or that among these are, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Self-evident truths. To them, axioms, in other words. And so just an illustration of what we mean by an axiom is a self-evident truth, one that really doesn't require proof. But often we look for things that illustrate it or demonstrate it without having to actually prove it. And then in all human language, not just the study of the Bible, we generally think that when you talk about principles of interpretation, or at least I always do, I always automatically think about the Bible. But the fact of the matter is, you can get out there on the internet, if you use Google or some other search engine, and type in interpretation, or you probably want to get a little more detail than that in what you type in for your search results to be accurate, but you'll find all sorts of things having to do with literature in general, talking in over another field about how people who are in the business of translating from one language to another and how they need to appropriately interpret what they're hearing before they translate it. You know, a wide range of areas where these principles are equally valid. So what we're talking about here as axioms are not just in the field of the study of the Bible. They're equally true in our viewing our own interpreting habits when we see things on television or hear each other speak, read a daily newspaper, or listen to music. They all have these basic axioms at the root of them. Okay, what's the value of axioms? Well, I just, separate from what he said here, just basically I thought of these things and I know there's others. It gives you an overarching, I call it, viewpoint. It gives you a structure from which to think about the whole subject once you recognize these general axioms. And I've even somewhere, maybe even later in his book, but I know I've certainly seen it in other books, sometimes you will come across something as you're trying to interpret that looks like it's the contradiction of the rule or even of an axiom. And yet you often will end up discovering even in its seeming opposition to it, it ends up proving the rule. It ends up demonstrating it. It gives us an overarching viewpoint. It guides us, that is, it points us, it moves us in a certain direction. It gives us a way to start at a beginning point and move forward. It's a guide. It clarifies. I have this problem all the time in the field of computers and working on the hardware or even helping other people understand how the software works. This, the new Windows Vista that's out now. People are struggling with it because Microsoft in some ways changed the human interface, the way you're interacting with the software to accomplish your purpose. But once I help some people understand the underlying principle of the reason why this is being done or what is happening, it becomes somewhat easier for them to have a clear picture of what they're supposed to be doing. I had Brother Sammy Flannery in my office yesterday morning. He uses an Olympus digital recorder just like I do, and he had recorded some things and he wanted to pull them off the recorder, put them into his computer, edit them, and then burn them on the CD. Well, he had been trying to follow the steps that were in the tiny little manual that came with his recorder, and he just wasn't getting it. So he came into me and he said, how do you do this? And I said, well, here's how I do it. And about the second step in, he says, I don't need just the mechanics. He said, I want to know why we're doing that. You see, that's what axioms do. They give us sort of the why we're doing this. If we're busy studying a biblical text, and we're trying to understand what the words in that text mean, or we're trying to discover more about the background. Some people may say, what are we doing this for? Well, we back out to the axioms. And we say, this is why. It clarifies our purpose and what we're trying to do. And the value of axioms is they're actually useful. I started to just put useful up there, but sometimes useful doesn't sound like a strong enough word. And so, axioms are to be used. Used every day. You use them every day. Every time you open your mouth to speak to someone else, you're practicing the very first axiom of hermeneutics. The true object of speech is the impartation of thought. You're trying to tell somebody else what you're thinking. And you're immediately hoping the second axiom takes place. The true object of interpretation is to ascertain the exact thought of the author. They're hearing you. You want them to understand what you're thinking. That's your goal, isn't it? And that's their goal. You're speaking as best you can your thoughts, and you're hoping they interpret. I heard someone speaking on the whole idea of communication, and they had these little pictures and so forth, and they had two heads. They were facing each other. And on one head, inside of that head, there was, you know, thoughts. And then also inside of that head were words and grammar and composition. And it comes out of his mouth. You know, here come these words composed according to certain grammatical rules into a composition of some sort. It might be a sentence, a paragraph, a speech, whatever. It travels across the airwaves, not radio waves, but just through the air, and strikes the ear of the other guy, the other head. And it goes through the reverse process, doesn't it? He analyzes the composition, the grammar, the words, and those all get converted back into thoughts. Now, the speaker, as he was talking, you know, over on the one guy, at the fundamental level of thoughts, here was something that was bright red inside this guy's head. And as he's doing all this, and the message is going across the other guy, inside of his head is something that's bright. If it's blue, real communication hasn't taken place. Miscommunication has taken place. If it's bright red, near perfect communication has taken place. If it's just sort of pink, partial communication has taken place. You grasp the concept here? And so, you know, this is what it's all about. This is what we're looking at. These 15 axioms of interpretation, which we've drawn here from this book, The Principles of Interpretation, is just one student of this subject's way of trying to encapsulate these things. Others who teach may have different numbers, different arrangements of some of this, different ways of saying it, but at the fundamental level, they're going to be the same things. Yes?
Well, and one of the things you bring up a good point about that almost goes overlooked is when people speak, they do it, whether written or verbal, they do it to get across an idea.
Yes.
And the audience that they're speaking to needs to receive the idea. The only way that happens is if they both are speaking the same language. Grammar is designed in such a way where the rules theoretically cause us to come up with at least very similar thoughts. You know?
Yep.
Even if there's like interpretation involved, even if there's metaphorical language involved, the person who's delivering the language is still their goal to impart the picture that they intend to impart.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't change what their goal is.
Now, different genres of communication, gives me the opportunity to say this one more time, different genres of communication have slightly different things that come into play. For example, written communication of all kinds is different than spoken communication. Here's why. In spoken communication, the communicator not only is using the words, the grammar, the composition, he also has the benefit, depending on if he's only being heard, like on the radio, he at least has the inflections of his voice, the pauses, the other things he can throw in as a part of his speech that contribute to the communication, right? And if it's visual, there's often also the body language that goes in. That's totally nonverbal. And yet, it's part of the communication process, and the recipient on the other side is interpreting not just what they're hearing, but also what they're seeing. And so we recognize different genres of this. Now, the Bible is a written communication, and good authors who write and know their audience is not going to hear them or see them try to give all priority to make sure those written words themselves can communicate accurately the thought they want the audience to have. They don't have the benefit. It's far harder actually to write for most people than it is to speak. I've developed the ability, whether it's a skill yet or not, at least the ability to stand up every week in a Sunday morning Bible class and a Sunday morning sermon and a Sunday night sermon and communicate that way, because I have the benefit not only of the words and the grammar of the composition, but also my audience can actually hear me. And so I can use emphasis and pauses and all sorts of things like that. But they can also see me. So I wave my arms and smile and frown and all those things that are nonverbal that are part of the communication. Now, to communicate exactly the same thing simply by writing it all down and sending it to someone who does not see or hear me, that's a challenge. It takes more skill because I've got fewer tools to work with. And yet, good writers are fully capable of doing that. Certainly, you have read things before that just in the reading of it, it evoked certain deep emotions in you. Perhaps you cried when you read it. You laughed out loud when you read it. You felt glum or uplifted when you read it. And yet, you didn't have the chance to actually hear them or see them. You only had just the words. Words are powerful things. These are the essential principles of all kinds of communication, and we're just happening to focus on those that are written primarily at this time. Okay, axiom one. The true object of speech is the impartation of thought. This is just an acknowledgement that in all of human experience, when people are speaking, they're trying to tell us something. Were any of you at the banquet the other night when Dr. Dennis Jones spoke? He started out his lesson with about 8 or 10 jokes, so if nothing else, you probably remember the jokes. Did you catch the one joke where the fella was going to go to Spain for something, but he didn't speak Spanish, and so someone else just gave him the advice, well, you don't need to speak Spanish, just speak slowly. So when he gets over there, he goes in a restaurant, and he wants to order something, and the waiter comes up, and so he says to the waiter, I want a bowl of beans and a glass of water, I don't remember all the details of the joke. So he says it very slowly and very distinctly. And so the waiter says back, you want a bowl of beans and a glass of water. And the man ordering said, yes. And I don't remember how the story finally turns out, but basically the guy at the table discovers that the waiter isn't from Spain either. He's an American student over there, you know, having to work a little bit while he's going to school or something. And so he speaks, obviously, the same language. And once the guy sitting at the table understands that, he said, then why are we both speaking Spanish? If you're from America too, you know, of course, I never were speaking Spanish. But if someone is speaking to you in a language you truly don't understand, they're speaking, for some of us, Russian or Spanish or Portuguese or Chinese or any of the other thousands of languages on our planet. If you don't know that language, no impartation of thought or very little is going on. Often people at those times have to resort to other kinds of communication, like, you know, pointing to their hand or taking out their billfold and trying to tell you owe them money or they want money or something. You know, try to use nonverbal communication because the verbal isn't working. They're not able to impart the thought through the speech. Yes?
I was going to say, too, on a biblical side note, one of the things, as far as language goes, one of the things that makes us, you know, it says we're made in the image of God. One of the things I consider, because I thought about that concept, and God could create something with just His Word. Mm-hmm. He created the heavens and the earth and everything in them. And we do the same thing, except in an imperfect way. We have the ability to create something out of nothing. When we use words, if I say red apple, you visualize the thought and the picture is created, not the physical side. The mental side is created out of nothing. That's one of the beautiful things I think language is part of. One of the ways that we're created in the image of God is we have the ability to create ideas and to create something out of nothing. The same way that God did.
Right.
So God is perfect.
Yes. In fact, the whole subject of language and communication with language is a part of the way we're made in the image of God. It sets us apart from the rest of the living creatures on this earth, for example. Scientists keep trying to find the languages of chimpanzees or dogs or dolphins or whatever, and they do have some communication skills, but they're nothing like what we have. And how there's such a huge gap in between humankind and even the highest of animal kind in that area is just incredible. But it's because we're made in the image of God, I'm convinced. So that's the first axiom. The second one, the complement to it, the true object of interpretation, then, is to apprehend the exact thought of the author. How important that is. How often we don't practice it. How often when someone is trying to tell us something, we're actually busy trying to discern their motive or something else other than actually trying to hear what they're saying. And part of that is because we've recognized that part of communication is nonverbal. And we're trying to jump beyond the interpretation of the exact communication to the more general concept of application. Are they mad at me? Are they praising me? You know, we're jumping beyond exactly what they're saying to what's over on the other side of that. But we need to start out by making sure we're actually interpreting accurately. We're having created in our mind the same thought that was in their mind. And how important that is in reading the Bible. As we read the epistles of Paul, for example, when he's writing to the Romans about this great plan of redemption that God had, we want to have that created in our mind. When we hear Jesus telling his parables, we want the thought he had in his mind and he was trying to create in his first audience's mind, we want that same thought or set of thoughts to be created in ours. That's our first goal. Our overarching goal. I think we said the very first day we were in here that the true object of interpretation is to determine the author's intended meaning. A-I-M. That's just saying this in another way. So these first two axioms are the beginning of the foundation of all human communication, not just the Bible. The originator of the communication is trying to communicate thought, a thought or set of thoughts. The recipient of that communication is trying to accurately understand or grasp or have that same thought in their mind. And that, in different contexts can be different things. Just take one word, fire. In the right context, if someone yelled out, fire! In here, while everybody else is running for the door, somebody's looking for a lever or something to pull to set off the fire alarm, right? But in another context, a man says fire, and a whole line of troops with guns discharge their weapons. In another context, a teacher in a classroom says fire, and a third grader stands up and says F-I-R-E. They're learning to spell. So you have to look at the context within which, and that's a part of the interpretation, to determine which of those three or probably several other things that the word fire could mean given in context. What What did the speaker mean when they said fire? Are they saying, I need to spell that? Are they saying to discharge my weapon? Or are they say the building's burning down, let's get out of here? True object of interpretation is to apprehend the exact thought of the author. This all depends on language being a reliable medium of communication. We really need to underline that word reliable. That does not mean perfect. Language is a reliable medium of communication. It's not perfect. It has both its limitations and its inabilities. You ever heard someone say to someone else, maybe you've said to someone or they've said it to you, I'm trying to get you to understand what I'm saying. Maybe their communication skills are your interpretation skills are not what they need to be, and so accurate, at least in their opinion, communication isn't going on here. Do that all the time with children, especially if they're your own. Do you understand me? In frustration. You're trying to get them to become better interpreters of what you're saying. Language is a reliable medium of communication. But it's only, and this is just a footnote to this one, it's only reliable if both the speaker and the hearer speak the same language. If they have available to them the same vocabulary and skill set, it would make that possible. That's true between different human languages. We named some of those off a while ago. Chinese, Spanish, English, French, Portuguese, German, whatever. But it's also true even within a language. There are sub-languages within languages. Think about some of the words in the Bible, for instance, that aren't a natural, normal part of most people's vocabulary who even speak English. Yeah, there you go. Especially if you're reading one of the older translations, thou or thee. But even no matter what language, mercy seat, redemption, gospel, baptism, regeneration. You have to learn the language in order to have good communication going on. Language is a reliable medium of communication. All right, now it moves from that more general statement, the overall picture of language being a means of communication, to say that usage determines the meaning of words. I jumped the gun and unintentionally there when I talked about fire. That's an illustration of that. That words have meanings that, generally speaking, are not exactly perfectly fixed. Their meanings not only can expand and contract depending on the context and the use that's being made in a particular instance, but sometimes they can even, because of the way most languages, including ours, works, they can even have a primary literal meaning and one or more secondary sort of figurative meanings. When my son was about 2 years old, the oldest one, and just had learned to walk good, we were always warning him about walking over and putting his hand on the front door of the oven. So he got to where, even when the oven wasn't on or anything and hadn't been on for a while, he'd come over and stand there and point at it and say, "Hot, hot." Some less than totally couth fellow sees a beautiful woman going by, and what does he say? Hot. Does that have anything to do with temperature?
I'm couth and I call my wife hot.
Well, what you do between you and your wife, I'm not getting into. But, but we have this basic word meaning, hot, which relates to temperature, right? But here now comes this secondary meaning in another context, using the same word, and there is a connection linguistically. Linguistics, the wrong word. There is a connection meaning-wise in the evolution of that word that ties its original meaning to this secondary meaning that it has. That's not just true in English. That was true in Greek. That was true in Hebrew. And so, usage determines the meaning of words. We're just acknowledging, I think, what is our practice every day, to use words in more than one specific exact meaning. Even concrete objects have some variation. And we say chair. You're sitting in a chair. In other rooms, there's other kinds of chairs. There's a different kind of chair back there, but it's still a chair. There's big comfortable ones, small ones with wheels on them, those that swivel, thrones that kings sit on. All of these are chairs. And so even they have some expansion or contraction of meaning depending on the context. Usage determines the meaning of the words that are being used in the language. Now here's one that's you need to realize, and that is that two writers do not independently express the same thought exact. I wish it had said the same thought, because I think that's the intention here. The same thought alike. If you're trying to explain something, and then I'm trying to explain exactly the same thing, I won't do it just like you do it. But the goal is the same, to communicate the same thought and for the hearer to interpret the same thought. But we won't independently, that is, without being in some kind of collusion with each other or something, do it exactly alike. Yes?
I was going to say, you know, it's interesting, like bringing this up just made me realize how two people trying to express the same idea will on purpose describe it in different ways to get a more full understanding of it. I mean, for instance, like you and I right now, you're describing it one way and I'm describing it another way, both with the goal of displaying the same idea, but doing it from two separate angles on purpose to give the idea a clearer meaning.
Yes. As a result of that, when we think about the Bible, just making the quick little preliminary application here, if we hear Amos in the Minor Prophets talking about the sin of Israel and what they're doing and what God's going to do to them, his communication is probably going to be a little or a lot different than Hosea's. They were not in collusion. They were not trying to just mimic each other. They're trying to communicate the same thoughts. But independent of each other, they don't do it exactly alike. When we read the gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, all four of them are presenting a treatise, each of them a treatise on the life and teachings and significance of Christ. To some degree, of course, scholars argue that Matthew, Mark, and Luke were not totally independent of each other. They were all drawing from a common, they say document. I don't think such a document existed. But certainly from a common community set of beliefs about Jesus. Whereas John seems to purposely try to separate himself from that already well-known community view of Jesus, as he writes. Now, I don't even know if that is accurate to say that, but that's what many are postulating. But even so, they still do it independently of each other. I spent over 2 years preaching through the Gospel of Matthew here a few years ago. Until I did that, I did not realize how different he was from Mark and Luke. I had always, like everyone else, tended to focus on the similarities. But it's amazing how different he is. while using exactly the same material in most places. Little differences in the wording, little differences in what he pulls out and highlights and does not highlight in other areas. Because then you back out and you start realizing he has an overarching purpose. He's got an overall plan he's working here as he writes this, and it was slightly different than Mark's or Luke's. So an author's purpose determines the character of his production. That's our next one.
You might go back to number six.
Two writers do not independently express thought alike. Number six, every writer is influenced by his environment. This is why we were emphasizing here two sessions ago. We need to know what the background is. Author speaks out of the language he knows, out of the culture he knows, out of the circumstances he knows, even out of his own background. We've had some famous communicators in our United States in Western culture. Martin Luther King Jr., Will Rogers, Franklin Delano Roosevelt are some of the ones I think of. John F. Kennedy. Each of them, although they all spoke English and were very inspirational and good communicators, they all spoke out of their own environment. And so you have, for example, Will Rogers, a real folksy kind of communicator, telling simple stories that were a part of the rural life of America at that time and so forth, and yet using that to really make very profound observations about people and about situations. Martin Luther King Jr., speaking out of his own background of both being of a minority race in America at a time far more even than now, when they were robbed of rights and privileges and so forth, and also out of his religious background, speaks out of that. Every writer is influenced by his environment.